Let's call this meeting of the House Finance Committee to order. Let the record indicate that it is 1:30 p.m. Good enough. Wednesday, February 25th, 2015. Present today, we have Representative Guerra, Representative Kawasaki, Representative Gutenberg, Representative Gaddis, Representative Munoz, and myself, Representative Thompson. Please make sure that your cell phones are turned off. Today's schedule, we're going to hear the introduction of House Bill 39. We will also have a recidivism reduction discussion with the Pew Charitable Trust. Our first order of business is the introduction of House Bill 39, an act establishing the Advisory Committee on Wellness and relating to the administration of state group health insurance policies by Representative Seaton. We will introduce this bill today, but this is the first reading, and I do not plan on having a public testimony or to move the bill out today. Representative Seaton, if you'd please come forward, place yourself on the record, and we'll hear House Bill 39. Representative Wilson's joined us also.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman and Committee. Appreciate the hearing of House Bill 39 today. House Bill 39 requires the Department of Administration to pursue initiatives and incentives to decrease the incidence of disease in Alaska. And we're attempting to hold the inflation of healthcare costs to 2% or less through the administration of this program and group health insurance policies and the state's own self-insurance. The bill creates a wellness committee in the Department of Administration. That's an advisory wellness committee. There is currently a wellness committee. However, this bill adds weight to that, not only by establishing in statute, expanding the membership, but also by requiring the Department of Administration to answer within 6 months the recommendations made by the Department of Wellness. So giving weight to those suggestions and recommendations and will be very helpful. What this bill does is it also requires annually the Department of Administration to give the legislature a report on how they are responding to those recommendations. As you may well know, advisory committees are advisory. It's not mandated, but the problem is if those advisory recommendations are not looked at or responded to, then you tend to have less work put into those committees. That's what this bill is intended to do, is to give more weight to that. It's based on the model that we use for the Citizens Advisor or Citizens Review Panel for the Office of Children's Services, where that review panel does recommendations and then the Office of Children's Services is required to respond to those recommendations, and that's proved a very effective model for improving the services. The question is, what will this do for us if we have a 2% inflation rate on health care in the workers and the retirees and their dependents in this state? We can eliminate $3.8 billion of the unfunded liability in the PERS and TERS retirement system. That $3.8 billion is there because health care is currently inflating at around 5%. And all of the deposits that were made were based on a estimate that health care inflation would be 2%. So that's what's created the unfunded liability for health care in the system. There are numerous documents that will give you as an example of one of the things we could be doing when we make the presentation on the bill and the PowerPoint of just what vitamin D could do, you know, getting adequate amounts. We have a number of studies that would look at that, and breast cancer, we'd be, you know, it's about a $6 million cost, and we'd save about $3.5 million of that if we just had wellness committee recommendations. And the reason we are looking at the workers and the retirees and their dependents is because we have a contractual relationship with those people, whereas people across the state, we don't have generally a contractual relationship, so we can't look at incentives or disincentives within those populations. In other words, can we change the copay? Can we change the deductibles to incentivize people to reach those goals? Also, Mr. Chairman, I know you're short on time. I also presented you a couple of other papers that are in the back, but one of them that just came out here this last year was looking at depression, and we know a lot of our problems here in Alaska relate to depression, and this is a systematic review and meta-analysis, which is what we do is we look at all the randomized control trials that have been done and then systematically review that, and that is on the back side of that, the which is the basis for healthcare models and standards of care. And if I could just read that short little paragraph.
We are joined by Representative Edgman and Vice Chair Sadler also. Go ahead.
The effect size for vitamin D in depression demonstrated in this meta-analysis is comparable to the effect of antidepressant medication and accepted treatment for depression. Should these results be verified in future research, these findings may have important clinical and public health implications. We know that many of the things that we're talking about within our population, and I know you're going to be talking about recidivism later, are due to depression and medical problems associated with low vitamin D rates. We know that the population within our correction system is maintained at either deficient or suboptimal rates of vitamin D because we don't provide that nutrition, and that's the basic hormone that regulates the immune system. So, Mr. Chairman, I think that not only will this look at the House Bill 39 as wellness, but maintaining wellness within our correction system, and when people leave that correction system, could have great benefits as well. So, thank you, Mr. Chairman.
The bill does not specifically reference vitamin D that you were speaking about, though.
That is correct. Vitamin D we are just using as a proxy and one demonstrable way in which the Wellness Committee could act through the Department of Administration.
Representative Seaton, also in the bill, I'm noticing on page 2 that you have this quoted, and my question is, what is the standard for legally and reasonably practicable as it's used in this bill? What is that standard? I'm just curious.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Yes, those words are put in there so that the Department of Administration, when they review the recommendations, they can say, well, you know, we can't impose something because of statute or regulation. They couldn't make those changes, or maybe it could be a HIPAA violation. You know, we don't know what the Wellness Committee is going to come up with, and it could be that some of those recommendations wouldn't be applicable within law. So the Department of Administration is not required to implement those, but they should look at that and see, can we legally do these, and is it practical? Is it going to cost us more money, you know, economically, or would we be imposing something that we wouldn't be able to accomplish? So it's to give the Department of Administration a lot of flexibility in their required review of the recommendations and report to the legislature.
Okay. I've got a few questions, starting with the Vice Chair Sadler.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Representative Seaton, good to see you again. I apologize that the answer came up during your previous testimony, but I noticed that you had proposed to have the Wellness Committee in the Department of Administration as opposed to Health and Social Services. If the question has been asked, I apologize, but why not in HESS and Administration?
Thank you, Representative Sadler, through the Chair. The only people that we have contractual in relationship are state employees, state retirees, and their dependents, so that we have some mechanism for incentivizing those people that we have a contractual relationship for. And the Department of Administration is the one that actually reviews the health policies and the self-insurance policies of the state employees and retirees.
If members could hold their questions down to a minimum, because we do have a long presentation for recidivism, I'll take a couple of more, we don't want to run over after this. So I'll go around and allow a couple more questions. Next was Representative Kawasaki.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Thanks for being here, Representative. Section 2, the new section that's being added, discussed a lot about health care costs versus the 2%. In the cost. So is it your intent for the administration to look, so much of the healthcare costs are based on insurance. So is it your intent that the administration look at the current coverage that they've got in place now? We've had a lot of problems with the current insurance for retirees and public employees, but is that something that you would like the administration to look at in terms of this bill?
Through the chair, Representative Kawasaki, the purpose of this bill is to have a healthier workforce and retirees so that we can change the cost escalation by having people healthier and not needing the health care system. We're not attempting here to change the insurance provisions at all. What we're doing is talking about people needing to get that insurance coverage because they're sick, and if we move upstream from that and do things that the Wellness Committee would have control over or would have recommendations for to keeping people from needing that, that will control the escalation in healthcare costs.
So vitamin D instead of Prozac? Nothing, I was just a joke.
Representative Guerra.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Representative Seaton, it seems like a good idea. I just don't want this bill to frustrate you in the future if it passes. And you mentioned that this is somewhat like the Citizens Review Committee, and I want to make sure that a flaw there doesn't exist here. The flaw there is if you speak to those folks privately, even though they're very cheaper publicly, they'll say they have a hard time getting information out of OCS, that they ask for information and they have a hard time. So with your bill, I just want to make sure it's written in a way where the advisory committee can get the information they need. And if you feel like there needs to be any tweak, I'd ask you to consider that since it's not going to pass out today, just before by the next hearing, and should be an easy fix if there's something that needs to be fixed.
And Representative Guerra, through the chair, there is a difference in the mission between the Citizen Review Panel, which is reviewing state operations, and the Wellness Committee will be looking at ideas out in the field for how we can keep state workers healthier, so it doesn't require the department to furnish them information.
All right, if you feel comfortable.
Okay. We've just been informed that the Pew people are about a half hour away. They're making another presentation, so we'll continue. Representative Newman. Yeah, got you there.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Welcome, Representative Seaton. I'm on page 2, section 2, where it talks about the greatest extent legally, and it directs the Department of Administration to hold health care costs to 2%. And then it also, I think, requires them, this is my question, is does it require them to work with the advisory committee, so or to implement the advisory committee's recommendation, because it says here, by administering policy, the health insurance obtained under this subsection in a manner that is likely to reduce the incident of disease, and that the facility's implementation of recommendations of the advisory committee on wellness under this statute. So does that mean that they have to take all the recommendations from the advisory committee and then implement them into their policy plans to try and ensure that there's a 2% reduction? Is that the intent?
Through the chair, Representative Newman, the intent here is not to mandate that they implement policies, but they are required to review the recommendations and report back. So there is a requirement that they answer, they look at the recommendations, but to the greatest extent legally and practical and reasonably practical, that's the standard that says, okay, will this work within the healthcare of or for the health of workers, state employees, and retirees. And so that's to help facilitate implementation of those policies that fall under that reasonably practical and legal scenario. So it doesn't mandate that they implement the policies. It only mandates that they review the policies and look at them and as much as they can to facilitate better health, that they would do those things.
Follow-up question?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Representative Seaton, on Section 3, it talks about, again, to the greatest extent legally, that the Department of Administration to hold the escalation of health care costs to less than 2% by administering policies. It's my understanding, I know when I've talked to the Department of Administration, they're already doing their best to try and keep health care costs down within the state. So I'm trying to understand the meaning of this paragraph. So do you think that if they were to take the recommendations by this advisory committee on wellness, that would bring the cost down? Is that because they're already working to try and keep costs down now?
And through the chair, Representative Newman, there was a wellness committee. There is a wellness committee. In the last 2 years, it's met haphazardly, missed most of its meetings. The recommendations that were being forward were not felt to be being answered. So there is already a wellness committee in the Department of Administration, but it has very little weight, and its recommendations don't have to be addressed. And so that's all this is doing, is saying here is a broader wellness committee, and the Department of Administration, who administers our health insurance and our self-insurance, will have to address those recommendations to see if they have merit, and if they have merit, that they should facilitate implementing those recommendations.
One more. I just want to get right down to the question here. You submitted a lot of information on vitamin D. Is it your thought that the Wellness Committee Advisory Committee would recommend the department to somehow require vitamin D for Alaskans to take vitamin D, and that would reduce the cost of health care?
Through the chair, Representative Newman, this is an example of something that the Wellness Committee might do, where you have a lot of scientific information saying that this is there. But remember, this is not broadly based on Alaskans. This is on people that we have a contractual relationship, our state employees and retirees and their dependents who we provide insurance for. So this only deals with those people that we have a contractual relationship to provide health care for. And so I want to make clear that there's no mandate across, for all the people of the state of Alaska. And what it would be is, since we have a contractual relationship for insurance and health with these people, we could offer incentives in copay changes or deductibles, other kinds of incentives that we sometimes try to offer, wellness programs, but Are there more that we can do? I think that there is quite a bit more that we can do. The vitamin D presentation that we have is just showing how, and to the extent that one of the things that they might recommend, because I know some of the people in there, I believe, will.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Do that.
Thank you. Next we have Representative Wilson and Munoz.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. So I guess I'm really concerned about the 2% per year. I mean, one way they can reduce that is by putting that additional cost over 2% on our retirees who are already paying a lot. So I'm trying to figure out if that would be one of the positions. And also with that, you're putting on the commissioner of administration, who he's not a doctor, last I checked, to put in place programs that will decrease the incidence of disease in the state of Alaska employees, both current and retired. So I'm concerned that this looks like we may pass on costs to keep it at 2%. And would the commission administration really have the expertise that you're calling for in this bill?
Through the chair, Representative Wilson. First of all, changing the cost structure of something that's been negotiated is not within the purview of this bill. But the other thing is, there's already a wellness committee. The Department of Administration is already looking at ways to constrain costs. The only problem is that there's no requirement that they review the recommendations of their own wellness committee and facilitate those recommendations to the extent legally and reasonably practical. So this is expanding on the work that the Commission of Administration already does. That is their job, to do the health insurance and the self-insurance that the state of Alaska does. So this is within their job of the Department of Administration. It's not within the job of the Department of Health and Services, because the insurance and self-insurance of both employees and retirees rests with the Department of Administration. And they've testified previously on this bill that they didn't object to this bill, that they thought it would help them do their job better. You know, hopefully we'll have them up here and you can ask them the questions whether this is not a mandate on them implementing something. It's simply a mandate that they review the recommendations and help facilitate those if they make sense.
Okay, one follow-up.
Follow-up, Representative Wilson.
You know, every time our insurance sends us tons of information on the things that we should be doing, you know, Weight Watchers group, maybe that just comes to me, but, you know, those kinds of things to do. So we're getting that information now. What really bothers me about this bill, that it appears that it's going to, if we're going to implement what it sounds like, that we're going to be looking at mandates to actually be able to reduce down to that 2%. Whether that means, you know, whether or not we're going to incentivize or de-incentivize people taking vitamins or other types of, you know, maybe a band, so we know how much we're walking. It just seems to me that this bill is heading down, that that's going to be what it's going to be, is mandates to lower the insurance. And I think we have in place what we need already if we just read the information coming to us. But I'll look forward to the department testifying.
And Mr. Chairman, I'd just like to respond that $3.8 billion, if we're willing to accept that as an unfunded liability and pay that over the years, just because of projected increases in health care costs, if we don't address those, I think that we are, that's the whole purpose of this bill, is to try to move Alaskans to, the insured Alaskan employees and retirees, to better health care status so that we have less unfunded liability.
We've been joined by Representative Pruitt. Next, we have Representative Munoz.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, and thank you, Representative Seaton, for the bill. I appreciate your continued work in this area and your commitment to trying to improve the health and wellness of Alaskans. So thank you for bringing it forward. I was curious with the contract, the third-party administration, the contract for the administration of our health care plans is currently in review, I believe. I'm not sure if it has been adopted yet or not, but I think we're close to being to adopting a new contract. How do you see this committee working with the administration reviewing the contract and making specific recommendations as we consider changes and re-upping the contractual arrangements that are currently in place?
And Representative Munoz, through the chair, I see this wellness committee as fully integrated with the Department of Administration. We already have in the Department of Administration a wellness committee. It's just not functioning well. It's had one meeting recently. It's been the information I got that was they were excited about this. There's been just, the committee just has not been functioning well over the past several years because the recommendations just weren't analyzed, weren't received, weren't acted upon. There was no response from the insurance provider or the department to their suggestions, and so, or to at least all of their suggestions. So this is, again, adding weight to a wellness effort that the Department of Administration already has. It's just that we want to make that effective wellness effort instead of one that is just kind of languishing.
Okay. And just one more follow-up. The previous administration did put into place a wellness program at the Department of Administration. I believe it was under Commissioner Hultberg. Did that change the outcomes of our health care costs, or did that help to lower the costs in the current contract?
Through the chair, Representative Munoz, I don't know the statistical methods of how much they did. I know that they really worked hard on cutting down smoking, because we know that is bad. And they also, under Commissioner Hultberg, is when they went to giving employees, active employees, free vitamin D tests. She looked at the information on that information. And if you go to the state health fairs, you get free vitamin D testing there. Those that are not within their system, you know, they didn't provide that for them, but anybody in within the system and the health care fairs, they did give free vitamin D tests to employees, because their analysis was that that particular initiative would be helpful.
Thank you.
Okay, we have next Representative Guttenberg, then Sadler.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. We already have, but we have a wellness commission inside of the admin. Representative Newman drug to the light of day the health care commission, which we heard from here, who we found out what they thought their mandate was, and that is full of, well, Dr. Butler is the chair of the commission now, full of health care professionals, administrators. Did you think of rolling this into that and getting the report through them instead of a healthcare commission a wellness commission that's not really functional at this time?
Representative Guttenberg, through the chair, no, I didn't, because the wellness advisory committee is made up mainly of state employees and people on the ground that see things differently than the medical establishment per se, and so we have this already, like I say, a wellness advisory committee in the Department of Administration, not in the Department of Health and Social Services, to look specifically at lowering the costs for employees and retirees, not looking at the general health of all Alaskans.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, but I think that is what. Thank you, Mr. Chair. I think that is what coincides with their mandate as well. So we'll let it go at that.
Okay. Next is Representative Sadler, then Representative Gaddis, then Edgman.
Thank you, sir. Two questions, if I may, briefly. You speak, Representative Seaton, a couple times about the existing wellness committee in the department. Does your bill envision sunsetting or killing that committee and replacing it? Does this propose changing, swapping out the wellness committee with the wellness commission?
Through the chair, Representative Sadler, this expands the advisory wellness committee within the Department of Administration. Expands the membership somewhat, has at least one healthcare professional on that committee, but the rest are people that work throughout, you know, the state government and see what's happening. You know, it could be on accidents that they could come forward with reforms on accidents to help the health status of Alaskans. So I'm not trying to, in the end, say what they're going to do. That committee is there. It's a zero cost. All of these people participate online or on their own time, and so that's the commission.
But if the
committee
follow up on that point, so I just want to make sure that if this bill becomes law, will there still be two different bodies working for the same end, or would there be one merged body?
Through the chair, Representative Sadler, this bill doesn't have anything to do with the health care commission. If the bodies choose to continue with the health care commission, if it's been effective for them, then that's a choice of the legislature. This only deals with the health care advisory committee that's established in the Department of Administration, looking at wellness in active employees, retirees, and their dependents.
Two. And I guess the second point is not really a question so much as a comment that I've got to do some thinking about. What gives me certain pause is, to the greatest extent legally and reasonably practical, we shall hold the work to reduce costs increase by no more than 2%. That just seems like some pretty hard edges and some firm language. I'm just wondering how much heft and weight and effectiveness this committee would have to achieve those things. It's a new paradigm for me. I got to take me a while to get my head around it.
For information, we do have Michelle Machard here from the Chief Health Official with the Division of Retirement and Benefits from the Department of Administration. She'll be coming up to answer any questions we have, possibly, too. Next, we have Representative Gaddis, then Representative Edgemond.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And actually, I'm going to piggyback one of my questions on Representative Sadler's, if you don't mind, because I really didn't get it clear in my mind. Lots of different names. So we've got a Wellness Commission, a Health Care Commission, a Health Care Advisory Commission. Can you tell me, and then this advisory, one is the Health Care Commission that I understand that we heard from, so I get that one, but you talked about an advisory commission, and then, of course, this one. Are those two, or are they one and the same?
Through the chair, Representative Gaddis, the only thing this bill talks about is the Advisory Committee on Wellness, which is in the Department of Administration currently, expanding their membership and giving them more weight in their recommendations and having the Department of Administration respond to their recommendations and report those, how they address those, to the legislature. So this has nothing to do with any of the commissions that might exist anywhere else.
Follow up, Representative Gaddis.
And thank you, Mr. Chair. And my original question was going to be this. So as I listen to my colleague over on the other side and from up north of me talk about certain liberties, I got to thinking to myself that, you know, we certainly don't want that. But then I reminded myself that this is a benefit that is being paid to our employees by their employer. So I don't see it as much as a liberty issue, and I'm the first person to look at, you know, taking our liberties. But at this time, when we have the growing cost of health care, I don't see this as a liberty issue. We had a bill to pool health care insurance last year. And again, we talked about our employees and how we could cut the cost of health care. So even though we may give certain incentives or de-incentives to employees, at the end of the day, they have the choice to take that benefit or not. So do you see it the same way?
Through the chair, Representative Gaddis, I do. I see it exactly the same way. This is responding to the health of the people that we have a contractual relationship for. Yes.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Representative Edgemond.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I'd like to echo the comments of Representative Jones, because I do support the concept of this. I think it is forward-looking, and it's something that will, over time, achieve the objectives of the bill sponsor, which is to reduce costs and to raise awareness and, you know, have a healthier working population of state workers in Alaska. But that said, just a couple of procedural questions or questions of the mechanics of the bill. As you've heard several times around the table here, it does sort of land on this holding escalation of health care costs to less than 2% annually, which is a pretty, and I know there's a couple of conditions here, but that's a pretty hard and fast objective. While at the same time, as I look through the bill, I don't have any notion of who's going to pay for the travel, the members, or the staffing from the department, or the administrative costs associated with a committee that ostensibly should be pretty active if you're going to have a deliverable of 2% a year, whatever, you know, it's going to be. This is going to be a pretty active, pretty engaged, functioning committee. So maybe give you an opportunity to talk a little bit more about that.
Thank you. Representative Edgemond, through the chair. Yes, this is a voluntary committee, and it meets electronically. It is meant so that the recommendations that they make will have weight and be considered. I think that we have a lot of employees in our state that really want to see a better state and a better health care, better health for the employees across the state. And they see things around them all the time that could be helpful in that regard. And so what we're trying to do is activate and give greater, I shouldn't say power, but greater heft to the recommendations they make so that they will be fully engaged and helping us improve the health status of the workforce and the retirees.
Follow-up, Representative Edgman.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. So maybe for future consideration to the member across the table's comments at the outset that, you know maybe the and I'm looking at page 3 where there's a description about a regional geographic balance, and the committee shall meet at the call of the chair at the request of a majority of its members. It just occurs to me that maybe that all could be strengthened such that you require it to meet 3 to 4 times a year or whatever in order to meet the you know, fairly large task that seems to be burdened with, I guess, for lack of a better term, if you will. But anyway, just a few comments to the bill. I do support the concept, and I appreciate that you bring it forward.
And Representative Edgman, through the chair, you'll notice on line 11 there on page 3 that at intervals of 6 months, the committee shall make recommendations. So they've got a charge to be continuously looking at health care and make recommendations each 6 months, and then the Department of Administration has 6 months in which to respond to those. And then there's also a provision that once a year during the legislative session, the administration will report on the recommendations and their responses back to us.
One other?
Yeah. And we just had the Health Care Commission here in front of us a couple weeks ago with an annual budget of $300,000 a year and a big list of things that were recommended to the legislature that somehow a lot of lines didn't connect, dots didn't get connected. And to me, that's what I'm juxtaposing this against in my mind, is that a volunteer committee charged with some pretty, the 2% annually, holding the escalation of health care costs, that's a pretty big task. And so I'm still, as I say, wrapping my head around the whole thing.
Thank you, Representative Edgman. Representative Kawasaki, and then we're going to call up Michelle.
Thanks, Paul. What's the current rate of health care costs escalation right now?
I haven't looked at it now, but it's somewhere in it's been in the 4.5% to 5.5% range
over the last several years.
Yes.
Okay. And just to follow up, the 2% that seems like a pretty bold move. But I did want to point out that there's a difference between healthcare outcomes, which we want to improve upon, and actual costs. And so I appreciate what you're doing. Thanks.
And Representative Kawasaki, if we can prevent diseases and prevent 100% of those costs from being incurred, all of a sudden the escalation in the total health care budget that we spend in insurance and self-insurance goes down dramatically. So that's the purpose of this. Remember, the 2% is in there because that was the target rate that was established in the ARM board for what was estimated as health care cost escalations. If we don't meet that, if it turns out we lower the by 1% or 1.5% instead of 3%, well, we've only saved $1.5 billion instead of $3.8 billion. $3.8 billion would be if we can lower it and keep it at 2% cost escalation. Of our eliminating that much of our unfunded liability. If we are not that successful, I believe we need targets, and I believe the Finance Committee generally wants people looking at missions and measures and targets and what's measurable and not. And so that's our target, is to meet the previously adopted escalation that was in the retirement system. So.
Representative Sadler.
Thank you. Real briefly, just looking through on page 2, line 9, would establish legislative intent to create initiatives that create incentives and methods to decrease frequency and severity of disease. I just want to clearly make sure I understand for the record that do you see the incentives and methods, which are like carrot and a stick, will those ever reach the point where a public employee would have to comply with either these incentives or methods or lose their job? I just want to give the chance to put a big sign.
Representative Sadler, through the chair, I don't see this as any kind of a punitive bill at all. I think we're trying to prove health care status. That would take
so, no.
That would be a no because we'd be getting all kinds of other hiring discrimination and things that this does not include at all.
Thank you. I appreciate that clarity.
Thank you, Representative Seaton. If you want to stay there for final words, I'd like to now call up Michelle Machaud, Chief Health Official, Division of Retirements and Benefit, Department of Administration. If you'd please come forward and sit with Representative Seaton and place yourself on the record. I think there's a few questions, and then maybe you have a statement you'd like to make also.
Thank you. My name is Michelle Machaud, the Chief Health Official for the Division of Retirement and Benefits. Thank you for having me.
Okay. Well, I'll start it off then. Right now there is a zero physical note from the Department of Administration, but in that physical note you have a statement in there. It says that the cost of specific initiatives recommended by the Advisory Committee on Wellness, some of which could be substantial, cannot be estimated at this time. Therefore, the department submits a zero physical note. Can you give us some specific examples of things that could escalate this physical note to be pretty sizable? I mean, what is that implying?
Well, first of all, currently we do have the wellness committee within the department, and we do have a wellness coordinator within the department, but they are focused only on the Alaska Care Employee Plan, which is about 6,700 people. We contract with our third-party administrator to provide lifestyle and disease management services, again, only for those 6,700 people and their dependents. To this committee now broadens that to the retiree population, which is, you know, another 67,000 people approximately, which we currently don't have any wellness provisions for. So any provision that is expanded to that many more people is going to cost us more money. And so, you know, there. And if a specific initiative, whether it be, you know, vitamin D testing or any other specific, something that is not currently provided under the plan is going to increase costs.
Okay. I guess also then to follow up a little bit, does the department have to implement the recommendations of this committee?
No.
Okay. I understand that Pew is in the building, so we'll try to work this up. Representative Guerra.
Mr. Chair, if you're ready for the next presentation.
No, they aren't in the building yet, or in room. They're still headed.
So should we run out the clock? Should we eat up time?
Yeah, that's what we're doing. We're running the clock out. That's why I keep calling on you.
Oh.
A touch, I do confess
oh,
it.
Oh, boy. Ouch. Mr. Chair, I've lost my train of thought. It's going to take me a while to come up with this question now. Is it the department's intention, and I hope it is, the department's intention to take the recommendations seriously, obviously evaluate them? It's not going to be a case where they send them over and you pay no attention?
No, absolutely, we intend to take them seriously. We too want to have a healthy workforce and a healthy retirement force because that helps reduce costs. And so we certainly are interested in any innovative ways in which we can do that. The struggle that we see is, again, any cost to implement is going to could potentially be difficult to maintain that 2% target, especially as the cost at the beginning would be increased. And the return might not be recognized until, you know, many years later.
Thanks.
Representative Wilson.
Real quick, sir, are we at the 2% for target for those Alaskans who are in the program?
No. We don't currently have a target. We simply have a goal to have healthier workers and reduced health care costs, but we don't have a specific percentage target.
If we can get the cost, Mr. Chair, of what is in place now for the people who are in the plan, for the wellness portion of it, because they said they're doing state workers, how much that's costing, we might have a better idea than, I mean, this is a substantial increase of people that might give us at least a chance of understanding that. And I can see our time's up as the room's been entered.
Yes, it is. Representative Seaton, thank you very much. At this time, I am going to set House Bill 39 aside, and we will have it coming back to us later. Now, next on the agenda is a discussion of recidivism, a reduction with the Pew Charitable Trust, and I'm turning the gavel over to Co-Chair Newman to do this portion of the meeting.
Thank you, Mr. Co-Chair. Earlier we heard from the Recidivism Reduction Group that was formed under House Bill 266 that talked about some strategies. Part of those strategies was to work with the Pew Charitable Trust to obtain those goals and work with them on further recommendations. Today with us we have Gary Vandlingdom. I'll let him go through his own. Let's see, the director and Stanford Turner. So, Gary, Gary's a lot easier to say. Or
Representative Newman, hi. My name is Suzanne DiPietro. I'm with the Alaska Judicial Council, and I'm just here with Mr. Is that better?
Yes.
Okay, thank you. My voice doesn't carry. I'm Suzanne DiPietro. I'm the Executive Director of the Alaska Judicial Council, and I'm here with Mr. Gary Vandlingdom, who is with the Pew MacArthur Foundation, and he is the Director of the Results First Initiative. The Judicial Council staffs the Criminal Justice Commission that was created by SB 64 last session, and we've been exploring ways to get resources into Alaska to support the work of the criminal justice system and actually to support the work of policymakers in Alaska who are working in the criminal justice and other arenas. And it was through that desire to bring those resources to the state that we came upon the Pew MacArthur Foundation. And Alaska actually has been in discussions with Pew MacArthur for a number of years or months in any event. But they're now up here talking to folks about the technical assistance they offer. And with that, I will turn it over.
Well, thank you. And thank you, Mr. Chairman. Thank you, members for the committee, for this opportunity to come before you and talk about our work. The Results First Initiative is a partnership between the Pew Charitable Trust and the MacArthur Foundation, and it really is about helping states identify what are the most effective programs out there based on the results they can deliver for the citizens.
Can we get your name? And
I'm sorry. Yeah. I'm Gary Vandlingdom. I'm director of the Pew MacArthur Results First Initiative, which is a partnership of the two foundations.
And Gary, we've got about an hour to get through this presentation, so I'll ask you to do that. If members have questions after that, we can ask questions when you're done.
Oh, excellent. Thank you so much. It's great to be here in Alaska. I didn't think I'd be saying this, but thank you for the opportunity to come up here and get warm. When I arrived here, it was a good 20 degrees warmer in Juneau than it was in Washington, D.C., where there was 6 inches of snow when I left. So I think that Alaska's been getting a bum rap all of these years in terms of the weather. So I was from Florida, and I can say that I think that if this continues, you could be a rival for the winter tourism trade throughout the country. We got into results first because we recognized the challenges that all states were having coming out of the Great Recession. The fiscal challenges that Alaska is facing now are similar to the challenges that states have been facing for a number of years. My home state, in Florida, where I was the legislative research director for many years, coming out of the Great Recession, Florida was down about over 30% in terms of the general fund. Florida was one of the first states into the Great Recession. The unofficial business model of Florida is selling overpriced real estate to people from up north. That tends to be a cyclical thing, much like the oil industry. And so Florida was one of the first states into it. And Florida is currently expecting to get back to its pre-recession 2006 levels sometime around 2016. So that tells you the depths of the challenges that Florida has had. And unfortunately, many states are facing those same tough choices. And what we saw was happening in the recession was state after state was doing around across-the-board budget cuts because simply there wasn't information out there to really make better, more strategic choices. There's a paucity of information that's out there in terms about the effectiveness of programs, and we really think that states need better tools to help inform the tough choices, and we think that there's a lot of evidence out there now that can be made accessible to legislators to really inform you in terms of what are the best programs that are out there that would deliver the best results on a dollar-for-dollar basis for the citizens of Alaska. And what we typically find is that in most states that we work with, there's really a paucity of basic sort of business information. Most states don't have a comprehensive list of all the programs that are being operated by the agencies and the providers throughout the state. There's not a lot of information on a dollar-for-dollar basis, how much it costs to serve people in each of those programs to give you comparable information. There's limited information on what programs are really delivering on the ground, and there really hasn't been a good way of comparing programs so that if you see a program and they're reporting, here's the number of people that we served last year and a different program is reporting, here's the people who graduated from my program and a different program is reporting things like here's how much it costs to serve people and to achieve a three-month smoking cessation rate. It's really difficult to really compare programs and see which ones are best. And typically what you hear is that when you're having a budget hearing, you'll have advocates come up and they tell what I tell Little Timmy stories, which is that rather than telling you about data, they tell you about, let me tell you about Little Timmy. He came into my program. He was getting into trouble. He was about to drop out of school, and after only 4 months in my program, he has graduated from high school, has been accepted to Harvard, won the Nobel Prize in Economics, and is a finalist on both Dancing with the Stars and American Idol. And if you cut a dollar from my program, you'll jeopardize the lives of millions of Little Timmies in your state, and I know you don't want to do that. Well, the question really is Timmy representative of the people that come through that program, or is it one person out of 1,000? There hasn't been a good way of going through that information. And we think that there's a better way. We think that there's a lot of systematic evidence that can be brought into the system. It just has to be packaged. And there is a lot of evidence out there now. Across the country, people have been doing very rigorous research over the last 40 years or so. Tens of thousands of studies have been done on a lot of different programs. So we know a lot about what works. The challenge is how do you get your hands around that? Because you know how fast the process works in a legislative session. And if you have a question for your staff, hey, I've heard there's some good criminal justice programs out there. Tell me about what works. You don't want them to have to say, great question, representatives. Give me about a year and a half, and I'll read through 30 years of academic journals, and I'll get back to you with a list of what seems to work, because you have to make the decision in the vote next week. So what we think, what we need to do is to find a way to bring that information into the process so that you have the benefit of our collective knowledge and can use that in the legislative process. This is what's being called evidence-based policymaking, focusing really on the bottom line of what we know about programs and using that to help drive the budget process to fund things that simply work better than other approaches. This is sometimes called the Moneyball approach to government. Moneyball, if you saw the movie or read the book, the story of the Oakland A's, which have about 25% of the money of the big market teams but also want to win some baseball games. So what they did is they basically decided, why don't we use data to help drive the decisions on what team we should be fielding? And by using data in a much more structured way than other teams, they were able to basically get a team that cost 25% of what the Yankees were spending, but actually was more successful than the Yankees over the last 10 years. So we think that same approach works for government. Let's identify what are the players, the programs that we can field that for a dollar-for-dollar basis will deliver the best results on the ground here in Alaska for the citizens. So this is a very much focuses on the outcomes, what programs can deliver, and it really asks, are these programs worth an investment? What would they really deliver for us? Is it worth the money that we're putting into them? And is there a dollar-for-dollar better option out there, programs that would achieve better results for the money we're putting into the system so that we can achieve better results not by spending more money but by spending the money we're spending better on programs that research has shown to be more effective? The way that this works is pretty straightforward. We work with states to ask a series of fairly basic questions. First, what are we funding now? What programs are we operating in this policy domain? What criminal justice programs are we operating now? And then what do we know about these programs? Looking at that national research base, is this a program that's been shown to be effective across the country, or is it a program we simply don't know much about? And basically saying, okay, first from an investment perspective, how risky does this look like it is? There are good programs out there that have been rigorously researched, that they've been shown to be effective around the country. That's less of an investment risk than a program that, you know, sounds good, but all we have are those little Timmy stories. We don't have data. And then the next step is let's do some rigorous analysis of those programs that we're identifying that have good evidence and really do subject them to a hard-nosed business assessment, cost-benefit analysis. What do we get if we put money into these programs? And do that on a portfolio basis to really allow you to compare those programs in terms of the investment returns that they will deliver, with a goal really of, again, achieving better outcomes by spending money better, not by spending more money. So the first thing that we do with a state that we partner with is ask the question, what programs are out there? Typically, we find something like this, that there's a list of programs where we identify how much we're spending on them, break them out by the percent of the budget going towards these programs, and this usually is the only type of information that comes into the session process, which is useful to know, here's what the programs we have, but it doesn't really tell you, you know, are these good programs or not? Well, by matching them up against what we know about programs, programs are now being rated across the country by research clearinghouses, and some of them are what we call green-rated programs. There's a lot of research behind them showing that these programs are effective. Some are promising programs that the research shows, yeah, this probably is more likely to work than not, but there's not a lot of research behind it, or the evidence isn't really strong here. Unfortunately, there's programs which sound good, but when tested rigorously, don't have any outcomes. The people aren't changed very much when they go through them. And very unfortunately, there's some programs which have sounded good, but when tested, make things worse. Actually, people who go through them are worse off than if we had left them alone. And by the first thing is to let's identify what we know about the programs we're funding and to do them sort of on this color-coded assessment of what we know about them. So when we do that in a state, typically we find something like this, that some of the programs that the state is operating, there's a lot of research behind them. These are evidence-based programs. States typically fund also promising programs, which are looking probably fairly good. We're just not quite as sure about the outcomes as other things the state may be doing. There's some programs states are operating that, unfortunately, the research shows they're ineffective. But usually states also operate a lot of programs that there isn't much information out there on. These are homegrown programs. They may be good programs. They may be bad programs. But we think that it's important to know what we know about the programs, because these risk programs really are more risky as investments than programs we know are more likely to work. So if there are programs that fall into this in this category, these are things that we would recommend that you direct your state auditor to look at, or to get partnered with universities to really ask the question, are these effective or not? And basically just answering that question about what we know about them. But it's more important then to really do the cost-benefit analysis approach. And here what we do is we use that national research base, those tens of thousands of evaluations, and then we apply that to Alaska-specific data. Because it's good to know that this was a good program in Georgia, but as you know, Alaska is not Georgia. Alaska has a unique population. The criminal justice population here is different. The sentencing patterns are different. So what we do is we use that national research base and apply this to Alaska-specific data. So basically, if a program is effective in reducing recidivism, what's it mean here? How much would it reduce recidivism? By how many people? By what crimes would be avoided if the people turned their lives around? And what would that mean in dollars and cents for the state of Alaska? So this is an example of how this works. Functional family therapy is a program that many states are starting to experiment with to deal with juvenile offenders. Typically, when kids are getting into serious trouble, states react by sending them off to a deep-end residential commitment bed. And basically, the idea there is we'll take the child off the streets, we'll put them in a secure facility, and we'll keep them there for 6 months to 2 years, provide them with intensive services, educational services, treatment services, drug treatment services, with the idea of let's help the child turn the life around, and when they've completed this, we'll put them back in the community, and they will stay on the straight and narrow and become a good law-abiding citizen. Every state does that. It's an appropriate thing to do, but there's a couple of challenges. One is those beds are really expensive. Across the country, it costs anywhere from $60,000 to $200,000 per bed per year for these facilities. So we spend a lot of money on them. The second challenge is typically a lot of the kids who go through these don't turn their lives around. This is Washington State recidivism data here. In Washington State found that after about 6 months, about half the kids who went through those deep end residential commitment beds were back in the system because they had reoffended. You go out a couple of years, it was over 60%. So basically what they determined was they're spending a lot of money on a program that doesn't get them where they really want to be. So the question was, well, what else could we do? Well, Washington State, like many states, is starting to put children in a different type of program. Functional family therapy treats the child in the community, provides intensive services, but in a community setting, the child stays at home. And in addition to providing services to the child, they provide services to the family, with the idea that if they deal with some of the dysfunction that may be happening in the family, the child may not feel the need to act out. And also, if we can teach the family how to discipline their teenager, we don't have to do that for them. And we can avoid the costs that deal with assuming that parental responsibility. So does this work? Functional family therapy has been examined around the country, and on average, those research studies have found it has about a 22% reduction in recidivism compared to what we traditionally do to those kids. So some of those kids still get into trouble, but they do so at a lower rate. Instead of, you know, half the kids getting into trouble in 6 months, it's about less than 40%. You go out a couple of years, and it's about 42% of the kids getting in trouble instead of over 60%. So it does have an impact. But what we want to know is, okay, what's it cost to achieve that impact, and is it worth it? What benefits would the citizens achieve by achieving that 22% reduction, and can we compare the costs and the benefits of doing so? Well, using this approach, this is Washington-specific data. That 22% reduction equates to about $29,000 in benefits. That's both taxpayer costs that are avoided because the kid's not coming back into the system, or we're not having to arrest them, prosecute them, defend them, put them in new systems. And also, those are victimizations we're avoiding because we don't just put kids in the system to help them. We do it because we want to have a safer society. So if we're able to reduce recidivism, it's not just the child who benefits, it's the people who are no longer being assaulted or robbed or otherwise offended against. So we're able to put a dollar value on that. There's been national research which puts a dollar value on the cost of different types of crime. So, for example, that research shows if there's a robbery, it has an average impact of about $250. That's the value on average of the things that have been stolen. If there's an assault, it's a higher value because it's health care costs, it's pain and suffering. And for very serious crimes, that is a very large number, obviously. So by looking at what crimes are likely to be avoided, we're able to put a dollar value on sort of the societal benefits of avoiding that crime. And that equates for both taxpayers and for citizens of about $29,000. There's also educational benefits for this because the child stays in the community. They're more likely to graduate from their high school. We know that kids who graduate from high school have better employment outcomes. So on average, about $9,500 per person who goes through here in terms of benefits for both society and for the child. Healthcare costs tend to go down, both because the kids are no longer getting in trouble and showing up in ERs, and also because they're more likely to become employed and get their own health insurance, so we don't have to pay those public assistance costs. So if you add up all those benefits, it's about $37,000 for the cost of about $3,300 to put a family through this, or about 11-to-1 return on investment, a pretty good buy for the citizens of Washington State, so that's why they've been investing in this program. So this is really good to look at an individual program, but it's more powerful if you look at this based on the portfolio of investment opportunities the state has. So by doing the same assessment, using the same approach, the same assumptions, the same methodology, we can look at sort of a Consumer Reports guide to investments in the criminal justice system and the juvenile justice system and other systems in the state. And what we typically find is that there's usually not a real relationship between what a program costs and what benefits it achieves. There's some programs which are fairly cheap and have decent outcomes. There's some which are pretty expensive, have good outcomes. But by putting it together, you can really identify what are best buys, programs that dollar for dollar deliver very strong returns. And these are things then which we would recommend would receive priority for funding considerations. So for adult programs, cognitive behavioral therapy programs, which are delivered in a group setting, are pretty cheap. In Washington State, about $400 per person. Produces about $10,000 in benefits or about a $25 return on investment for every dollar invested. Now, that's not as big as electronic monitoring, which is about $22, but it's better than some other programs on a dollar-for-dollar basis. On the juvenile side, aggression replacement training, which helps kids deal with frustrations in positive ways instead of acting out and getting into trouble, Washington State found that they get about $37 back for every dollar they put into it. and unfortunately scared straight, which is pretty cheap. It's only $66 to deliver in Washington State, but unfortunately it's a very effective program if you're trying to increase crime. Research shows that kids who go through that program are more likely to offend and are more likely to commit more serious offenses than kids that we leave alone. So even though this program has its own TV show, basically sending kids to prison for a day to be yelled at doesn't work. It demystifies prisons, and they hear things other than just don't do what I did. They hear things like, have you considered doing this instead? Because there's more money in it. So Washington State found that they were losing almost $200 for every dollar they put into that program, and that's not what we want to see states doing. Domestic violence treatment program, the program that many states are doing, unfortunately, has been shown to be ineffective. Iowa found that the program that they've been operating for many years actually was costing the state money. The people who went through it were more likely to offend than the people who didn't. And they've replaced that program with an alternative which is based on cognitive behavioral therapy programs and is being effective instead of continuing a failed program. So that's the type of analysis that this allows a state to be able to do, using the national research but then marrying that to state-specific information to give you an idea of what your agencies are likely to achieve if you invest money in different programs. We're currently working in 16 states across the country. We've been doing this for about 4 years. We typically add about 4 states per year to this. You can see that we are working in both very red states and very blue states because at the end of the day, I think everybody agrees that we should invest taxpayer dollars in things that work. We may disagree on how much money we want to invest in different programs or how much money we want government to have, but you know, I think everybody can agree let's invest in things that can deliver strong outcomes for our citizens. I want to focus and give you an idea what this looks like in a couple of states. Mississippi, we've been working with for a couple of years now. The legislature has really embraced this as a way of making it their choices and budget decisions. Now when agencies are coming forward or advocates are coming forward saying we would like money for this program, what the legislature is doing is asking them the question, what evidence do we have that would work? Because we only want to put our money in things that we think are going to actually deliver good results for us. They've gone through this process. They've developed their inventory of criminal justice programs. This year they're planning on replacing an institutional program, which unfortunately they found wasn't working, with something that will be working. They passed legislation that is establishing a framework for evidence-based policymaking. They've defined what they mean by evidence-based programs and by promising programs. And the idea of that was just to get everybody to think along the same lines and have a common vocabulary. So when people are talking about evidence, everybody agrees what that is. And they're looking for ways of then building this in, reinvigorating the performance budgeting system, because this approach can be used to not only say these are good programs, but here's how effective they should be. And that allows the agencies to work with their providers and say, okay, well, we're going to give you money for this program. We expect a 20% recidivism reduction because that's what the research shows this program can deliver. And it's good to know that you've gone from 5 to 7% outcomes, but how come you're not at 20? Because that's what the research shows this program can accomplish for us. New Mexico is the state that I think has done the most with this. We've been working with them for about 3 years. They've implemented this model in all the areas that it's currently built out. So they're doing this analysis in adult criminal justice, juvenile justice, child welfare, substance abuse and mental health programs, early childhood education, prevention programs, and they've done some work in K-12 as well. They've done a couple of cool things. First, they've really looked at what the cost of doing nothing is, because what they've been able to do is look at the costs that are incurred to the state when certain situations occur. They come up with a cost of recidivism and a cost of child welfare re-abuse, for example. And they were able to go to their members and say, based on the people that we released from prison in 2012, if nothing changes, those people are going to cost the state over $300 million over the next 12 years. And that basically gets people's attention that if we want to have more money in the future for things we care about, are there things we could be doing that are very cost-effective now that will bend those curves and get us better outcomes for our citizens? They've also used this approach now to target almost $57 million to evidence-based programs in criminal justice, early childhood education, and some prevention programs, because New Mexico is a fairly poor state. It has big social problems, and the legislature knows that it needs to invest those programs in things that will deliver strong results if they want to get the outcomes that New Mexico wants to have. To give you an idea, you're going to hear about a couple of different Pew things over the next year or so. Pew has two different initiatives. They're very parallel, but they are somewhat different. The Justice Reinvestment Program, or called JRI, is an initiative that our sister project, the Public Safety Performance Project, works. What that project does is it works with states to identify what's driving the cost in the criminal justice system. They work with a stakeholder group to really look at what are the policy options that the legislature may wish to consider to change some of those things, looking at things like sentencing patterns or diversion programs, with the idea of reaching a consensus that the legislature can then use as a legislative package for next year, identifying options that work for Alaska but would help save money down the long run. And typically as part of that, they work to see if are there ways that if they're able to save money in the future by reducing the growth of the prison population, is there a way to reinvest some of those savings back in the criminal justice system, improving programs to really create a virtuous cycle of continuing to invest in things that will produce good recidivism reductions, and basically while holding people accountable, also do so in a cost-effective way that also improves public safety. But then after that process completes itself, probably next year, then that project would move on to other states. Results First is more of an investment advice tool and advisory service. What we do in Results First is to work with your staff to implement this in Alaska. It's an ongoing process. We've been working with some states for four years, but it really is very much of an Alaska-driven process. It's building these tools with your data, with your staff doing the work, so it becomes a resource that's available to you not only next year but in future sessions as well. So we don't look at policy. We really look at programs and how you can invest taxpayer dollars to achieve the outcomes that you want to achieve for the citizens. They are very parallel processes. They're very complementary processes, but they are distinct, and I want to try to avoid confusion between them, because when you hear Pew, keep in mind that there's two different things that Pew is doing in this policy area. So what's it take to join Results First? Really three things. One is a commitment to evidence-based policymaking, that recognizing that there's good evidence out there that we can make better choices and get better outcomes by spending money in a more productive way. What we look for a state is a letter of invitation from the legislature and from the governor's office. So we'd be looking for a letter that's signed by the presiding officers and by the legislature and by the governor to basically say, yes, we want to partner with Results First to bring these tools into Alaska. The ability to provide data based on the conversations we've had in the state this week, we think that Alaska has the bandwidth and the data necessary to get this operational, and the willingness to dedicate the resources for this. Now, the good news about this is the hard work of doing the lit review and building the econometric model has been done. So the lift in a state is pretty minor. Typically, it's less than one FTE to customize this model for the criminal justice system. That's divided between people who are doing data analysis and the agencies, as well as the folks who are building the model. So it's a pretty light lift, but you know, just recognize this does require your staff to do a little bit of work in this. We would try to make it fairly pain-free, but this is something that you'll have to tell your staff that you want them to do and to make it a priority for them, so this will be available for you in time for next session. We also ask that a state appoint a policy work group. We think that the Judicial Commission is a very good work group for doing that. Basically, these folks would be in charge of sort of making sure that this happens, creating a situation where you can give directives to the agencies who have to provide information, making this a priority, but also becoming ideally champions of this, that they can help communicate what this is about to other members, other policymakers, to constituent groups that this would affect, and basically help explain this information is coming into the process. Also establish a staff work group would be charged with making this happen. Fortunately, the University of Alaska up in Anchorage has already volunteered to chair this, and we think that that's a good house for that. Once this model gets operational, it can also reside on the laptops of folks, the Finance Committee staff, as well as the governor's budget staff and the agencies, because our goal is that this becomes a resource that can be used by all the people who shape how money is spent here in Alaska. So our goal is that this becomes something that is a strong investment tool. Also, collaborate with us as we learn about what is working across the country. Every state is doing this differently, as they should, because every state is unique. The states are doing different types of innovations for doing this. We want to be able to share that. For example, the work New Mexico did in the cost of doing nothing is something that many states are starting to take a look at now. And ideally, we'd like to be able to see the cool things that your staff are doing and to be able to share the successes of Alaska as this moves forward. So what we do in return is we provide the software and train staff to do this. This is a capacity building thing for us. It's not us coming and doing this. It's training your staff, working with them as they do this on Alaska-specific data staff, because we want you to own this. We want this to become a resource that is part of the culture of Alaska, that it's your staff doing this analysis with your data, so have you confidence in the results. We'll help interpret what this means for policymakers, we'll compile those lessons learned, and we'll continue to update this model. Our goal is to really capture the knowledge of what works and to make it accessible to states in a growing number of policy areas. Long term, we want to be able to do this on all major budget drivers to give you the best information for what's working in education, what's working in controlling Medicaid costs. That's the work of probably a decade to do as we build this into other policy areas, but it is operational now in 8 policy areas that will continue to grow. And the cool thing is that there's no charge for our services. This is fully funded by Pew and MacArthur because these are both foundations that are passionately involved in helping make the world a better place by harnessing the knowledge that's available to us and helping other states do that. So we view this as an opportunity to really learn from Alaska, share Alaska's successes with other states, and ideally help the country move forward as well. So that, in a brief presentation, gives you sort of a 30,000-foot idea of what this looks like. As you can imagine, it gets pretty technical as you get down to the weeds. I didn't want to get into that. But this is designed to be a very transparent process. So if you have questions about this, we want to make this something where you can get answers. We want you to have confidence in the results that your analysis will provide to you. But at the end of the day, this is something where the choices that will come out of this are going to be yours. We will not lobby for any particular policy outcome. We're just here to help the process move along in the best way it can.
Thank you, Gary. First, let's address the cost. You said that you invest your monies into doing a lot of this, but you still require some work through the legislature. I believe I heard you say that the University of Alaska Anchorage volunteered to organize a group and chair that group and work towards some ultimate goals. And then again, we've had the reduction recidivism group in here earlier that I helped work to get organized. Just as the finance committee here then, what would you expect the cost of the state or investments of the state to be in something like this?
We're projecting probably going to be about one FTE over the next year, and that would be parts of existing positions, so we don't think there would be any fiscal new funding required.
So one full-time employee is what you're saying?
Well, I think it would be making it a priority of staff who are already there.
We live in FTE. I'm trying to figure that one out.
I think probably about...
Mr. Chairman, would you mind if I took a stab at that?
Yeah.
Thank you. So it doesn't have to be one person, although I think a couple of other states have chosen to designate one particular person to be sort of in charge of doing the work. Here in Alaska, I don't think that's really an option, or at least not a very good option. And so what we think is that for the initial work of building out the model at the very beginning, for say the first 6 months to a year, that the University of Alaska can absorb that workload in cooperation with existing agency staff. So, for example, there is a person, unfortunately, I think only one person at the Department of Law who has access to data that would be needed to build the model. She would need to give that data to the university. They already have agreements about sharing data, so that would have to be worked out for this purpose, but the agreements for sharing data would be made. The data would be given. She probably would be called upon to answer questions as the analysis goes forward, so there would be some of her time, and that's sort of the way we're seeing it proceed, that it would be staff from the University of Alaska Justice Center, existing staff, calling upon the various people in the agencies who have the information that is needed to build the model, who already are doing that work. So it would be a little extra work for them, though. And potentially you know, we don't exactly know all the information that's needed, but potentially needing to ask others in state government who have access to information about programs, how much programs cost, what programs are there, that kind of thing, calling on them to provide information that can be put into the model.
So then my understanding, just to clarify that, is the University of Alaska Anchorage would help organization. They could already absorb some of the costs that it would take to do that, and they volunteered to do that. And then it's just them working with different departments within the Department of Administration and their staff to put together a full program. And then you would need a letter of support also from the legislature with the co-chair and governor's mm-hmm. signature. Okay?
Yes.
Just making sure we're clarifying what it takes to get started. Mm-hmm. Obviously, we're looking at the high costs in the state in corrections. A large part of that, you know, is drug and alcohol abuse type programs and corrections, and trying to reduce recidivism that way. And so we took a good look at that. What is your success ratio that you've had in other states? We saw a map that had states on there where you've implemented this. Mm-hmm. What's your ratio of success within those states?
Part of that reflects changes we've made in the program over time to reflect the lessons learned that we have. What we've learned over the last couple of years is, in addition to getting the model operational, it's important to get it in the right places and to get strong buy-in from the legislature and the executive branch at the beginning. In a couple of the early states, we started with the Department of Corrections raised their hand and they put this in the research shop and they built a crime model. The challenge was the research shops, some of those agencies don't talk to their own budget staff, let alone the legislature, let alone the governor, so they were able to do the analysis, but the state didn't do anything with it because it was housed in the wrong place. So in the states that we're working with now, we're being much more deliberate about where this is being operated. I think New Mexico is the state that's done a lot with this. This is housed in the Legislative Finance Committee, which has a program evaluation staff that's organizationally attached to that. They've partnered with their Justice Data Center to populate the crime model, but then they've also partnered with Department of Education and Social Services to build those components of the model as well. But because that staff is core to the budget process, then that information has reached members and they built this into their bill analysis routines. So as this information has been available to them, they've used it because it's pretty compelling and it's driven reforms in criminal justice as well as other policy areas. We're using that approach to work with the new states. So we use that same approach in Mississippi. They're doing some strong things with it. Some states are doing some very unique things as well. For example, New York and Massachusetts have both used this as part of their scoring for grant applications. When the state's giving money to local governments for criminal justice programs, they thought in addition to the state doing things that make sense, if we're going to give money to the local governments, let's make sure they do things that make sense. So that's part of the scoring process for the grants that they give to local governments and really leveraging that. So in terms of the states that have the model and they're operating it in a place that has strong uptake in the process, we're seeing millions of dollars being moved in those states. It is something that obviously has to fit within the state culture, and you know, that's where we look for insights from our state partners.
Thank you, Representative Sadler.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I've got a series of questions if I could develop. First one, Mr. Van Lendingham, I appreciate your perspective as a former Legislative Affairs Finance Director. That's you've been there. You've seen the needs we have. All good state legislatures have some, you know, try to base their decisions on evidence. We have in our state, we have missions and measures. Mr. Craig Holt is giving that to our department. So my question is, if states already have evidence-based analysis tools, would your Pew's tools, you propose to replace them, complement them? What would be the interaction of current systems in place that you might bring in?
Representative, I think it's a very complementary approach. In Florida, my office did a lot of program evaluations, and I think the frustration I always had was that gave you a lot of information about this much of the budget, and you have to deal with this much of the budget. So we built this really to use information that's not only nationally available but state information. So if your staff is doing a program evaluation, it feeds directly into this model because the national research base is a way of estimating what the impact is in Alaska. If you've done an evaluation here through the university or through your staff, that is Alaska-specific evaluation information. That's the best use of of research, so we want to build that into your model. In terms of things like performance budgeting initiatives, I think it really helps reintegrate those into the process. Florida struggled to do that, and what we saw is that agencies came forward with information that you couldn't do anything with from a budget perspective. And it turned out to be a management tool, not a legislative tool, and I think that this helps make that worthwhile for a legislature, because it identifies from the research what things should be measured by the agencies, what things should be reported to the agencies, and what their performance should be in some of these program areas. So instead of the agency saying, well, we think that, you know, for functional family therapy, we can report the number of kids that we're serving, so why can't you report the recidivism rate 3 months out? Because the national research gives you a way of doing that. And it also tells you what you should be paying attention to when you're monitoring your providers, because that research shows there's about four things you have to get right in that program for it to be effective. So it really can be a tool that can help the process, but integrates everything, all the approaches that the legislatures traditionally do in the policy process.
And to follow, if I could, I would love to see and learn more about how you actually calculate that cost-benefit ratio, that kind of precision and ranking. Helping us rack and stack would be fascinating.
Sure.
But the question I'll ask is, what is the universe? There's no page number, but you have what is the universe of different program effectiveness database? How many different programs are they all about? Corrections, recidivism? Are they on health policy? Are they on environmental policy? What's your view?
There's around 100 programs in the crime component of the model. That's both adult and juveniles. There's probably 100, 150 of programs in substance abuse and mental health, and we're building it into other policy areas as well. So all told, the cost-benefit analysis model has around 250 programs that it can look at. We've supplemented that by looking at the national research clearinghouses and really building a clearinghouse of clearinghouses, because they're going through this research and identifying what they think are promising and proven programs. So out of that database that we've built, it has about 900 interventions in those policy areas. So all told, between the two approaches, a little over 1,000 programs.
And again, these are focused on behavioral health. What's their primary focus?
The model and the clearinghouse database now look at criminal justice in both adult and juveniles, child welfare, substance abuse, mental health, early education, K-12 education, and we're starting to get into Medicaid. And we're planning on expanding that to new policy areas over time. We started with social policy because there's a lot of evaluation knowledge in those areas.
So that's in the 900, that's in the 250 or the 900, is that wide range?
Well, both of those, we built both of those resources that are looking at the same policy areas now.
Thank you.
Representative Edgen.
Mr. Chairman, I appreciate the presentation, and to me there's no question that this approach works. I think that's a foregone conclusion, but a couple of questions come to my mind, and the first would be, when you talk about crime across the country, are we broadly talking about crime in the context that most of the crime is minor offenses? That sort of builds into the bigger crimes and the broken window theory, if you will. And is that the subtext to all this? And that's why you can have a measurable impact if you get these programs on the front end?
Sure. I think that the research has been fairly clear that there's some things that are very important in getting right in criminal justice. Swift and sure, it tends to be more important than length of penalty, severity of penalty, which sort of makes sense that, you know, if we catch you, we will do this to you, and we're pretty sure that we will catch you, as opposed to, oh, and now it's twice as long for your sentence if we did that. We think that cognitive approaches, helping people deal with their own behavior, is the thing that is important. Socializing people into good behavior patterns is important. I think that has proven things. Overall, I think it's important to pick good programs, make sure you do them well, and target them to the right people. Doing a program that has been shown to be ineffective doesn't get you anything. Doing a good program badly doesn't get you anything. And unfortunately, states across the country haven't invested enough in program fidelity. when we say, here's a program, go forth and do good, and we just cut all of your oversight, and that's probably a mistake often. And then targeting a good program to the wrong people is a bad idea. For example, you catch a kid who's carrying a joint, and to teach him a lesson, you put him into a program for high-risk heroin abusers, probably isn't teaching him the lessons that you want him to learn. So it really is paying attention to not only what we're doing, but how we do it and who we give it to. And I think the research has shown that if we get those things right, we can have a dramatic impact in people's lives. But it's really disciplining the whole system into paying attention to what works and putting money towards those things.
So as a follow-up, Mr. Chairman, the last 10 or 12 years in Alaska, we've gone from a percentage of a ratio of nonviolent to violent offenders. I think it's not. We're now up from, it was 48% in 2002 to nonviolent offenders, to now we're up to 64%. And as I understand it, most of that's alcohol and substance abuse. Mm-hmm. Is that the profile for a typical state in the country?
I don't have that information in front of me, but I think generally that has been true. I think growth in most states' prison populations has been due to dramatically increasing sentence lengths, particularly with things like three strikes laws, as well as dealing with the increase in perceived increase in drug offending with criminal sanctions rather than treatment has been something that many states have done.
And then my last question, Mr. Chairman, would be, again, I guess not to ask you to compare Alaska to any other states, but we're highly unique compared mm-hmm. to any other state that has a large number of tribes or Indian reservations or non-contiguous communities, either by non-road access or non-waterway access or whatever it might be. But even though I support this approach, I know it works. I know we have to go there in order to save money. At the same time, I'm still a little, you know, skeptical on the sense of it all that that with 230 some far-flung communities that this program could really serve its truer purpose, because it's going to take incredible amount of monetary investment by the state, with, you know, the state that is, you know, is facing incredible budget deficits maybe well into the future. So I on one hand, I know it works. I know we've got to go there. But on the other hand, I'm a bit skeptical in terms of its application, at least on a statewide basis in a state like Alaska.
Very good concerns. I want to say that this doesn't put the budget into a box that you push a button and the budget comes out. It really informs the process in a new and powerful way. But the tough choices are going to stay tough choices. Typically, there's never going to be enough money to do everything that you want to do. And this will not be the only thing that you pay attention to. It may not be the most important thing you pay attention to in many of the decisions. Legislatures are about value choices. And economic efficiency, which this tells you about, isn't the only thing we pay attention to or should pay attention to as a society. That there's programs that all states will put money into, which the research shows may not be the best overall return on investment, but because for various very good reasons, we need to deal with this. And this is the best approach we have now. So I think it is something that informs the process. I don't want to say this will answer every question that you have. It won't. That there's a lot of things that the state may be doing that, you know, will take some time to turn the ship around with. There may be things the state is doing that there's just not a lot of research on that are probably good bets right now until we have better research there. But I think by making the research of the things that we know more accessible, it can help you steer the ship in the way that you want to steer it in.
President Garrett?
Thank you. So there are at least two components of helping us not build the next prison. Mm-hmm. And we're getting really close. And one of them is what you've presented in large part. And one of them is us realigning our criminal sentences so that we take a look at crimes where maybe we're sending people to jail for far too long if they're nonviolent. Mm-hmm. And that seems to be a faster road to adopt some of those more quickly. In other states, when they do this comprehensively, is that the experience that the recalibration of sentencing part happens more quickly, and then the other part takes longer. And then the second part is, that's for you, and the second part is for you, Suzanne, which is, I take it there's coordination between this and the Criminal Justice Commission that's also doing similar work, right?
Yep. In terms of your first question, yes. Our colleagues, the Public Safety Performance Project, the way that they operate is that they will work with the state for a year to really identify what are the drivers of the system, to give you research and then present options, and then the state picks a set of reforms that make sense for Alaska, and you would pass that next session. And that's what that process would be, basically trying to level the curve and avoid building new facilities. As part of that, the question becomes, okay, where do we go from here? And, you know, if we are able to bend the curve and free up money, reinvesting part of that money back into the system to ideally come up with ways of continuing to manage the system as the population grows without having to get back to the problem we have now, because we're able to reduce recidivism and not have people come back. That's where Results First comes in. So Results First is more of a long-term, how do we invest our money? But our Public Safety Performance Project is dealing with probably the instant crisis of how do we, you know, avoid building this new facility next year.
Through the chair, if I may answer Representative Guerra's second question. So I just wanted to, I just wanted to respond to Representative Guerra's question about the Criminal Justice Commission. So as staff to the Criminal Justice Commission, the Judicial Council is working both with the Justice Reinvestment Project and with the Results First Project. And we are hoping that if the state should choose to partner with Pew on these two initiatives, the Criminal Justice Commission is looking forward very much to using the data that will come out of that and the sort of knowledge that will come out of those that work to inform its own work, including, for example, being able to model if we decreased the sentence for a particular crime by X years, could we predict how would that save any money? That kind of information, I think, as I understand from Mr. Van Landingham, can be available using the Results First model, at least to take a sort of a rough estimate at it. So that's the kind of information we need those. In my view, the Criminal Justice Commission could benefit very much from those resources.
Just one follow-up, Mr. Chair.
Yeah.
This is for either of you. I've only read just very recently something that I guess other people already knew. And it's the concept that swift justice is more effective at reducing recidivism than long sentences. I may have that wrong, but what do you have to say about that?
The national research is pretty consistent with that. The way I personally think about that is like dealing with my kids when they were little, saying that, you know, you did something and here's the consequence, gets their attention much more than, because you did this in a week or two, I'm going to get around to doing something, and now you're going to be grounded for the next 3 years at that point. That is not the way that we tend to think. So the research tends to show that the things like the HOPE program, which is sponsored in Hawaii, which deals with offenses, and it's like, if someone is reoffending, it's an immediate sanction, like for the weekend, to get people's attention, which has been shown to be more effective than, okay, we'll put you through the regular process, and in 6 months we may put you in jail for 90 days, which is cheaper, has more impact on recidivism, and doesn't have the negative consequences of costing people their jobs and all the other things, which makes it harder for them to stay on the straight and narrow.
Thank you.
Representative Haddon.
Thank you. Briefly, sir, we've heard the Texas Smart Justice or Reinventing Justice, Jerry Madden's program, has been held as the exemplar of evidence-based reduction in recidivism and so forth. Has Texas signed on to the Pew's program?
Yes, sir, it has. We're currently operating, we're partnering with Texas. It's being done on the Legislative Budget Board. That work is still being done. There's still implementation phase. They put out one report to inform a choice that the legislature is considering this year, but it's really too early to tell what Texas will do with this. We have high hopes.
I appreciate you making your presentation. It's intrigued me. Is any of this information, results of this, available just in the public domain, or is it proprietary information?
We are trying to make this very transparent. For example, the Clearinghouse database of clearinghouses is up on our website now. You can go to the Pew website, click on results first, and look for the Research Clearinghouse. That's up there. We will release a new version of that probably next month, which will be a bit more user-friendly to web users, that you can click on programs and you'll see a rating of them, that you can click down and look at the research behind them. So that'll be available. We have case studies from many of our states that those are up on our website because we want to share that information to the states. Our goal is to eventually have a case study in every state we're working in. That's just going to take some time to do. So we want this to be a very transparent process.
Thank you. And I would like to try and wrap up about 3:20 or so if we could, Representative Bettenberg.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. So a question I have, and I recognize that this program is at various stages of advancement in different states, and it's really heavily data-driven and then results from the data and experiments. But how consistent are you across all these states on evidence and results coming out of the programs that are in place and what's happening now? I mean, I know you would probably have to break it down into population groups and income levels and stuff like that, but how consistent are you seeing? I mean, I'm not suggesting or going near, you know, you don't have to do the research here, just implement what another state has, because, of course, Alaska is unique, right? But just wondering where that is.
Great question, sir. What we're seeing across the country is the same set of programs usually look pretty good because the research is so compelling that they're effective programs. Some states have been able to do more with that research than others have done. For example, Washington State, which has been doing this for 20 years, is able to look at return on investment for 20 different cohorts of the criminal justice population because they have a very robust risk assessment process. So they'll say, here's what it is if you want to put money on high-risk offenders or drug offenders or the general population, and that informs choices of how to spend money in the system. Most states can't do that. The rankings of individual programs varies a little bit by states because of the cost of delivering those programs. For example, a program that may give you a 2-to-1 return on investment in one state may actually give you a negative return on investment for another state if the cost of delivering it is so high. So some of the really heavily unionized states that we work with have very high costs for some of these programs, and that just sort of tells you where you are and helps inform the choice. So I would say that it's generally consistent, but with some interesting variations.
Representative Gaddis.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. It intrigues me that the university might be our centralized area that may do the research. Who's doing that in the other states?
It varies in different states. Typically, our goal is to put this in some place which is an honest broker that's close enough to the process where you can turn to them and get answers during the legislative session, and that's different in every state. So in most of the states we're working in now, it is in a legislative finance office or governor's budget office or a university center which is closely aligned with the process. You don't want it someplace that is so far removed from the process that you never hear about it, and all you hear yet is another report on top of the 50 reports already on your desk for today. We found that putting it in an agency is probably a mistake because it doesn't get to policymakers' attention. And one of the things that we're doing this year is we're changing the software platform of this model. It has been a standalone application, and it's now going to be a web application. What that means is it can be on lots of different people's laptops once it's built, so it can work, and it can sit in David Thiel's shop, it can sit in the governor's budget shop, it can sit in corrections. Basically, the people that you turn to for information will be the places that you want to see this resource available to you.
Thank you,
Madeline. Okay, we're going to wrap up. I'd like to thank the folks from Pew, and we'll get together later and talk about a few issues and maybe how we can start moving forward on this with the state of Alaska. I think that this organization or this committee feels in full support of what we're doing here. So thank you for what you're doing.
Well, thank you, Mr. Chairman, and thank you, members of the committee.
Okay, I do have a couple notes. My wife is out at the hospital with Representative Nagyak's wife. Benny is doing okay. Doing better. So our colleague Benny's doing okay. He'll be spending the night at the hospital, but he's doing okay. So I know that he's all in our prayers, and we're all thinking about him today. With that, there is no finance meeting on Thursday or Friday the 26th or February 27th, so does not mean that we don't have lots of work to do. So thank you for your attention, members. Adjourned.